Hello, I'm Lina Khmoudou. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we will take a look at sudden cardiac arrest. A sudden cardiac arrest is a medical emergency. So is a heart attack. Experts say a sudden cardiac arrest is different from a heart attack and happens when the heart malfunctions and suddenly stops beating. A heart attack is when blood flow to the heart is blocked. According to the American Heart Association, about 90% of people who experience a cardiac arrest outside of the hospital die. Cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, increases the possibility of surviving a sudden cardiac arrest. Research shows that a higher survival rate after a cardiac arrest is more likely among patients who receive CPR and who live in Western countries. Recently, American athlete Damar Hamlin experienced a cardiac arrest during a game. He was released from the hospital and is now home. Take a listen.
Earlier this month, American football player Damar Hamlin collided with player T. Higgins during a game. A few seconds later, the Buffalo Bill player laid motionless and was surrounded by medical personnel and stunned players. The 24-year-old athlete suffered from a cardiac arrest and received CPR before being rushed to the hospital by ambulance.
Mr. Hamlin suffered a cardiac arrest on the field, and it was promptly recognized by the Buffalo Bills medical staff, and that allowed for a very immediate resuscitation on the field. He was promptly resuscitated. It did require CPR and defibrillation, and at which point he was transported to University of Cincinnati Medical Center, where he was met by Dr. Pritz and the trauma team, as well as our emergency medicine colleagues.
Cardiac arrest occurs when the heart gets out of rhythm and suddenly stops beating. The person stops breathing, no longer has a pulse, and may lose consciousness. According to the U.S. National Institute of Health, the incidence of sudden cardiac arrest increases with age, and older people are more at risk of sudden cardiac death. However, young athletes can suffer commotio cordis, a blunt trauma to the chest resulting in irregular heart rhythm and often leading to sudden death. Hamlin survived his medical incident and has been discharged from hospital, as doctors continue to try to pinpoint the cause of the cardiac arrest.
He appears to be neurologically completely intact, and there is no reason to believe that he won't continue his path to recovery.
Researchers say sudden cardiac death remains a leading cause of mortality around the world and accounts for up to 20% of death in Western societies. Populations in low- and middle-income countries carry an increasing burden of cardiovascular risk factors such as obesity and high blood pressure, placing them more and more at risk of sudden cardiac death. Experts say treatment within the first few minutes of a sudden cardiac arrest, such as administering CPR, is vital and can save the person's life.
For more on cardiac arrests, I spoke with Dr. Ankit Shah, a sports cardiologist with MedStar Health.
Dr. Shah, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
We hear a lot about heart attacks, but cardiac arrest is something that has been in the news recently with the American football player. What is a cardiac arrest? How do we understand that as opposed to a heart attack?
The heart functions as a pump, right? And so the pump, the function of it is to send blood, which is oxygen and nutrient rich, to the rest of the body, to the heart, to the brain, to the kidneys, to the muscles. And so in cardiac arrest, it's essentially an abrupt loss of heart function. It's typically caused by an abnormal heart rhythm called ventricular fibrillation, and where the heart's quivering. So normally the heart beats as a synchronous thing where it's squeezing in a synchronous fashion, and then the blood gets transferred to the rest of the body. In ventricular fibrillation, it's just quivering, and so the function is essentially lost. And then the organs don't receive their oxygen and their nutrients. And if you don't act within a few minutes, it can lead to sudden death. The difference with heart attack is that's actually a heart artery problem. And so the heart also needs oxygen and nutrients to function to become that pump. And so it has coronary arteries. And so when you have a blockage in one of those arteries, that can lead to a heart attack. So a heart attack can lead to a cardiac arrest, but they're two different things.
Who is more at risk for cardiac arrest?
So there's a lot of underlying causes of cardiac arrest. One of them can be a structural abnormality. So you have a genetic heart problem with the heart muscle, something like hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is an abnormal thickening of the heart. You can have something called arrhythmogenic cardiomyopathy, which is another genetic heart problem. You can have a primary electrical issues, so genetic heart problems like long QT syndrome or Brugada syndrome. You can have the coronary artery disease, so a heart attack that leads to it. And in certain cases, you actually have a structurally normal heart. Something we're going to talk about is commotio cordis.
Yes.
And in other cases, it can be non-cardiac or not primary cardiac related, so like drug overdoses, cocaine can cause cardiac arrest. And sometimes big lung clots, blood clots to the lung, pulmonary embolism can cause it as well.
What are some of the signs of a cardiac arrest? Because you explained very clearly that it's different from a heart attack. So how do we know someone is having a cardiac arrest?
Yeah, I mean, so in terms of a heart attack, the typical symptoms, there's chest pain, chest pressure, chest tightness, radiation to the left arm. You might have some nausea or sweating. Cardiac arrest, it either might be nothing, someone's just feeling fine and then they collapse and they're unresponsive. Or before they go down, they might feel lightheadedness, dizziness, shortness of breath for a few seconds, and then they collapse. But in heart attack, they're typically awake and telling you they have certain symptoms.
Okay. You mentioned commotio cordis, and that's something that is related to an impact to the chest. But it's related quite often to young athletes. How so? Can you explain a little more?
Yeah, absolutely. So commotio cordis is, as you mentioned, so it's a blunt trauma to the chest, typically over the left chest, right over the heart cardiac silhouette. And it's most commonly seen in sports and athletes in sports that have like a hard projectile. So baseball and cricket, you can see it, hockey and lacrosse. And there's studies been done on animal models, which have been fascinating, and actually show that it only happens in like the perfect storm of events. So it has to be that hard object at a certain speed, clearly right over the heart in a perpendicular fashion. And then there's also a very vulnerable period within the heart. It's only sort of 20 to 40 milliseconds of time when the electrical system is resetting. And so all of those things have to happen at the same time, and then that can create this commotio cordis. Now, we think it happens in younger folks more commonly for potentially two reasons. So most of the cases happen in young adolescent males. And one of the thoughts is that the chest wall is not as developed, and so they're more susceptible to that chest hit. And the second is just the raw number of people participating in sport is much higher. So if you take the amount of people playing lacrosse, baseball, hockey, cricket, when they're 15 compared to when they're 40, you just have a lot more people at risk.
Mm-hmm. And how can it be prevented in the field? I mean, you talked about the fact that maybe their chest wall is not as developed, right? But they're playing these sports that are very intense and aggressive. How do we protect young athletes?
Yeah, so there are certain things you could do actually on the field that might mitigate the risk, but nothing you can do completely eliminates the risk. Mm-hmm. So a couple of things is you try to teach the athletes to avoid a direct hit. So if they're in lacrosse, don't take the lacrosse ball right to the chest. Try to turn off to the side and have it glance off you. Same thing with a hit. Try not to take a hit right to the center of the body. You can use softer balls. They have safety balls, but they're always not practical because the league still requires a certain ball. And then more recently, there's been a vest or a new guard that's been like a chest protector that's been proven to decrease the risk of commotio cordis. The old ones that were used have actually are for safety, but don't actually reduce the risk of that specific condition. So using that chest protector can be helpful. Ultimately, we can't prevent every episode. And so the most important thing, as we've seen, is having an emergency action plan and being able to get CPR, AED, and shock the athlete if they need it as soon as possible.
Now, we just went through the FIFA World Cup. Can you tell us, in terms of soccer specifically, how much of a risk there is with soccer when it comes to commotio cordis?
Soccer is a little bit lower. I mean, the standard sports typically are those hard, smaller projectiles. So the risk is a little bit lower in that sport.
Let's talk about best practice when someone has a cardiac arrest. What are the first things to do for anybody if there is no medical help? And then we'll talk about medical help. But first, any average person walks around and sees someone having a cardiac arrest. What is the first thing to do?
Yeah, so if you see someone that collapses and they're unresponsive, you want to call 911. And then if there's multiple people, you want to ask someone to get the closest AED. And then if you know how to, start CPR.
AED being?
Automated external defibrillator. And so Usually every public place will have it. And so you can either call an employee nearby or look for it. But that's if you have a second person. And then the first person goes to the person who's collapsed and starts CPR if you know how to do it. That's chest compressions on the chest, about 100 to 120 beats times per minute. And then as soon as you get that AED, that defibrillator, you want to apply it and let it decide if it needs a shock. We know from data that what we recommend for athletes now is that you try to get that defibrillator on and deliver a shock within 3 minutes of the collapse if you can. And that's because the data that we have essentially suggests that every minute of delay in the shock reduces the chance of survival by 7 to 10%.
So would you say that everyone should learn how to do CPR?
Oh, yeah, I absolutely would encourage that. I mean, there are some states that now have laws for high school students to graduate. They need to learn CPR. But I think as a community, that's one of the best things we can do. It's easy. You know, there's hands-only CPR taught by the American Heart Association and a lot of other really good organizations, but learning that would be extremely helpful for the whole community, for yourself, for your family, for your friends.
There's no age where it's too young to learn CPR. Anybody can learn at any age.
Yeah.
So there's a child who is like 6, 7, can that person have enough strength to administer CPR to someone who's like 25?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, each child is going to be a little different, but ultimately, if they can call 911 and get an adult, that would be the best thing.
Okay.
But something's probably better than nothing.
What should people do in general to prevent cardiac arrest?
There's a few things. So for someone I would split up into two categories, one with people with known heart disease and one with people without any heart disease. So if you go to the latter group first, so someone who has no heart disease, it's to really live a good, healthy life. So avoid the smoking, avoid drugs, make sure you're seeing your doctor regularly. So if you have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, or diabetes, that's treated, that's acknowledged. You try to exercise, actually 150 minutes a week of moderate exercise. That can be brisk walking. It doesn't have to be marathon running. It can actually reduce your risk of having a heart event. And then the other category is people with known heart disease. So either you have a genetic heart problem or you've had a heart attack. Working with your physicians to make sure all of your risk is as best controlled as possible. And then in certain conditions, there actually is a recommendation to have a defibrillator placed, an ICD, implantable cardioverter defibrillator placed, to protect you from that risk of sudden death if you are higher risk. So that's the way I would think about it.
Okay. So let's talk about symptoms. What should people look for? What sort of symptoms are we talking about when we talk about cardiac arrest? Because you mentioned the fact that it's sudden, right? But are there some preliminary signs?
Yeah, so it depends on the underlying cause of the cardiac arrest. Like as we said, there's electrical things that can cause it. There's structural heart problems like abnormal heart muscle. And then there's coronary artery disease, among other things. And so in terms of what someone should do or symptoms they should look for is anything that seems out of the ordinary. So if they typically are feeling fine and they all of a sudden start feeling a little shortness of breath, a little chest pain, chest pressure when they're doing their normal activities, they shouldn't sort of blow that off or ignore that. You know, having a regular involvement with a primary care physician is critical. So you shouldn't try, you know, having that relationship is really important. So you have, you know, you have trust in that provider and that provider knows you and knows how to sort of interpret your symptoms and what you're experiencing. So that when you do call, say you've been following someone for a couple of years and then in the year 4 or 5, you say, you know, I'm feeling a lot odd. They'll have a good read on how to sort of interpret your symptoms and where to go with you.
Okay, Dr. Ankit Shah. Any final words before we wrap?
No, I think, as you said, I think, you know, encouragement of learning CPR would be one of the big takeaways from all of this. And then if you are hosting events, is to make sure you have an emergency action plan and defibrillators available.
Dr. Ankit Shah, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
That was sports cardiologist Dr. Ankit Shah with MedStar Health. Experts say athletes can experience heart events during games, and the fans are not exempt. Euphoria, stress, anxiety, grief. Sports fans often experience these emotions and everything in between. Football has been described as an emotional roller coaster. According to research, acute cardiovascular events such as heart attacks and cardiac arrhythmia among hospitalized patients increase due to the stress that comes with watching a soccer match such as the World Cup.
It was a celebration like no other for an entire continent, with the historic qualification in the semifinals of Morocco to the World Cup, the first for an African country. Mahmoud, a Moroccan who lives in Mali, can't stand still. He releases his stress on the container stuck in his hands. At the final whistle, he admits he was on the verge of a breakdown.
Wallahi, it's stress.
Wallahi, I was so stressed. My body was shaking. It's amazing.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
This day, stressful of the quarterfinal was preceded by another full of surprises.
In Coupe du Monde, avec tant de surprises.
A World Cup with so many surprises. Yesterday, I would say that my heart was beating out of my chest. It was so intense.
Dr. Modibo Dombia, a cardiovascular thoracic surgeon, say the fans should be level-headed to avoid some health crisis.
Keeping calm regardless of the score and the event that occur is a key. That's because these are people who have existing heart conditions. So when there is an unfortunate event, they will stress, and the stress will release certain hormones. These hormones will create specific plaques in the vessels, which can go and clog the coronary arteries responsible for heart attacks.
A theory supported by Abdul Karim Sanogo, a fervent supporter of Paris Saint-Germain.
Being passionate is good, but I think you have to have a limit, especially when you know you have a condition. We must, in fact, be measured as such as possible.
Dr. Samuel Ogbondeminu is Deputy Director of Sport Medicine Department with Nigeria's Ministry of Youth and Sports. He discusses why people with certain health conditions should be mindful of their emotions during sports competition like the World Cup.
Dopamine is a precursor of adrenaline, and mainly they are both produced from the adrenal glands, which is a small bean-shaped organ located over the kidney. But as well, dopamine is also produced along our digestive tract and in the midbrain, the hypothalamus. Find out that dopamine is responsible for the feeling of satisfaction you get, the feeling of pleasure and motivation, whereas adrenaline is come up when we, there's a kind of a situation where you need to fight or flight. When you have high level of dopamine in the body, one, well, it's helped you to be able to increase your ability to learn, which we might say it's good, but it can also cause sleep deprivation. It can increase your libido, the sex drive. So when adrenaline is released, that prepare you to fight. The blood are diverted to the muscles, getting them ready. Glucose level to the muscles are increased. You find out that the breathing can become shallow. The surge of adrenaline, when it becomes repetitive, it is known to damage the blood vessels because of the increased heart rate that it causes. It can lead to arrhythmia. The multiplier effect of some of these things, it's sudden cardiac arrest, stroke in an individual. Adrenaline is not as if it takes pains away. It makes you to momentarily forget that something is a kind of a danger. Sport fans, when the adrenaline surge is high, you find out that some of them, it can lead some of them into unnecessary disturbances that we see in some games. Because you see some people, you already have a background health condition. It's not advisable that you want to go to, because the kind of surge of adrenaline, the power that comes in that gets you to hyperventilate, find out that because of attachment to a game, the surge of adrenaline can lead some people to have sudden cardiac arrest. And that's why you find out that in some stadium, you find out that there are places that you have AED.
That was Dr. Samuel Ogbondeminu, Deputy Director of Sports Medicine Department with Nigeria's Ministry of Youth and Sports, speaking to us from Lagos, Nigeria. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Welcome back to Health Chat. The Rockefeller Foundation has donated $10.7 million grant to the United Nations World Food Program to help vulnerable children get better access to nutritious food through school feeding program. The initiative aims to strengthen school meals for millions of children in Benin, Ghana, Honduras, and India. The 2.5-year initiative focuses on including fortified foods in school meals, as well as advocating for more nutritious food throughout the programs. For more on the subject, I spoke with Mehdad Essani, Vice President for Africa Food Initiative with the Rockefeller Foundation.
You know, school meals are the world's largest social safety net. Over 388 million of children are covered currently. We need to do a lot more. And so that's an important way to try to meet the food security and nutrition needs of children. What's important to say is that, you know, in the Global South, 90% of the budgets for school meals are covered domestically. So governments are showing commitment. But we're only covering, you know, less than half the children in the world. So we do need to up our game. We need to cover them more coverage. We need to have better quality meals. And so that implies other countries and bilateral partners need to help them.
So talk to us about how the school environment is a strategic setting to address undernutrition among children.
I mean, schools are a great way to reach children if you want to reach them en masse, rather than a dispersed approach, which is, you know, a household approach. You know, also an institutional market can garner the attention of the private sector, the food processors, the supply chain as a whole. So institutional markets are not small. You know, the world spends $45 billion a year on school meals. You can wave that as a big stick to attract attention, to say, actually, we're shifting. We want more nutritious meals. We want meals that are more homegrown. We want meals that are more sustainable and resilient. So I think school meals makes a lot of sense in building a consumer base. And definitely, there will be spillover effects. Where institutional markets lead, there will be secondary markets opening up in mass markets. So I think it's an excellent way not only to reach children, but to start to shape consumption patterns.
So the initiative is targeting 4 countries, India, Honduras, Ghana, and Benin. So why these 4 countries specifically? But more importantly, how will the program be implemented in such a way that empowers local providers in the value chain?
So, you know, we've tried to select countries that we felt the school feeding was at some scale, that there was domestic support to grow it, that the countries could play an influential role in sharing best practice with others. So some of these countries serve on the leading task force of the School Meals Coalition, which is a coalition of 73 countries. So if they bring that evidence to the table, we hope that that might be influential. Other countries like India, their public distribution system covers 800 million people. So there is a mix of outreach and influence and these sorts of factors that have helped us choose the initial category. But of course, this is just the initial foray. There will be much bigger plays to come. As far as the role of local providers in the value chain, you know, the focus now is very much on the role that local procurement can play in knock-on effects for the rural development. There's a lot of evidence in other countries where this has played an extremely positive role. So this is an opportunity and a challenge. It's an opportunity of new markets for local farmers, but the challenge is we need to help these supply chains be reliable in supplying safe food at the right quantities that are needed. And so that will be a process. But ultimately, I think that's where governments are incentivized, and World Food Programme, our partner, is highly committed to this.
So the greatest part of the Rockefeller Foundation's Good Food Strategy, what else can you tell us about this strategy and what can be done in general to help communities become more resilient in the long run and help themselves and feed their families and feed themselves?
Yes, so for the largest part of its history, the foundation invested in fighting hunger and productivity gains, but we found a laser focus on empty calories was not the way to go. And so we have the recent Good Food Strategy. And so that focuses on nutritious, sustainable, and inclusive food. As part of your question about what can local communities do to become more resilient and food secure, I think it needs a coordinated action, both at international, national, and local level. Clearly, farmers need support to move towards more resilient crops, for example, tree crops, other kinds of grains and crops that are drought escaping. They're going to need the extension knowledge and the infrastructure that goes along with that. But I think also governments, at least in Africa where I live, you know, they made a commitment to 10% of public finance towards agriculture. We're not achieving that. So there needs to be some more advocacy, perhaps, to make sure that that sort of support is coming so that the right infrastructure, extension systems, the right kind of food trade exists in the region. Because with climate change, we're going to find shifting surplus and deficit areas. We need to be able to move food efficiently between these surplus and deficit areas. So I think these are all part of the equation of trying to become more resilient and food secure.
That was Mehdad Ehsani, Vice President for Africa Food Initiative with the Rockefeller Foundation, speaking to us from Nairobi, Kenya. It's been 20 years since efforts to prevent the transmission of HIV/AIDS from mother to baby during pregnancy and birth began in a big way in sub-Saharan Africa. But about 130,000 babies are still becoming infected each year because of logistical problems like drug shortages or the stigma attached to AIDS that makes women reluctant to seek tests or treatment. Anurita Baines, Global Head of HIV/AIDS Programs for the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, tells VOA's Carol Vandam that although there's been tremendous progress made over the last three decades and 76% of adults now get treatment in sub-Saharan Africa, only half of infected children are being treated.
We've seen this incredible scale-up of access to treatment for people living with HIV. And what we have realized, have been slow to realize, that is that a lot of that treatment has gone to adults living with HIV. It's absolutely critical. We've made tremendous progress, but we're seeing now a treatment gap. So despite the progress, we're seeing many critical gaps, and we're seeing that that progress has been uneven.
If you drill down further, it seems that women are not seeking treatment as much as men. Why are women not getting treatment?
So when we look at East and Southern Africa, which carries the global burden of the HIV epidemic, you know, there are a number of complex reasons that women, men, children are not able to access treatment. So what we do see is that actually women have more interaction with health facilities, so they do seek treatment. And that's why we've seen this tremendous progress in prevention of transmission of HIV from pregnant women living with HIV to their children. However, it's not as simple as just, you know, going to the clinic down the street and being tested and getting treatment. So we know about stigma and discrimination. We know that sometimes there are very sort of practical, logistical problems to accessing the clinic or seeing a nurse or a doctor. That might include having money for transportation to get to the clinic. And we know that there are a number of things that drive the inequalities and contribute to the barriers, gender inequality being one of them, economic hardship, not feeling empowered and confident enough to disclose to your partner that you're not feeling well or that you've been tested and you're living with HIV and need to be on treatment.
That is Anurita Baines, Global Head of UNICEF's HIV/AIDS programs. She was speaking to my colleague Carol Vandam from New York. That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For more health news and medical breakthroughs, visit voaafrica.com. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linoch Mudu, in Washington. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
We are bringing women voices to the conversation on things that matter to the hearts and minds of women. From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent. We hear your voices, our voices. Right here on VOA on Wednesdays